questions? Yes, sir. Instead of deciding who's higher, you know, 2 points for the Dolphins, and I think you just, if you look at it from the point of view of an entity that has certain work to do through form, an entity takes a form that is appropriate to the work it has to do, and it does that work. And like some entity takes a form of a rock, and some a human, and some a dolphin, and some a bird, and some a whale, and each of them has certain limitations and certain options that force a certain kind of work on themselves. And I think it's better, rather than deciding higher or lower, just to see that you and I have certain kinds of work to do that include this kind of getting trapped in our intellect and losing our intuitive and then regaining it. And that's the particular uniqueness of this particular group of beings that we're talking about at the moment. I mean, Buddha pointed out who these are that take human birth, and he said, notice that they all have greed and lust, agitation, ill will, sloth and torpor, and doubt. Those are the five hindrances. Then you've got the 10 fetters, and then you've got the 22 no-no. I mean, there's a lot that describes who we are and what we're doing here. But we all have much on our plate to work with. And that's fine. That's the stuff of why we're humans. Questions? Well, I think I did in talking about my stepmother, about illness and disease in relation to death, because it's at the culmination of your life that there is the real opportunity to transcend your own separateness. And those kind of conditions are only suffering for the somebody who's somebody. When you're not somebody, there's no suffering. There's just phenomena occurring. And so it's like the advanced course, if you will. It's the one that really pushes your buttons at that point. Now that doesn't mean you close off your heart to it. You got to keep open and do the best you can to help people. I mean, this is not to be used as rationalization for non-action, all right? But it is an understanding. So that when I deal with somebody that is in pain, I'm helping relieve the pain at the same moment I'm understanding the way in which it's working to help them grow. Question? Yes? Yeah.
It's like one of the things that this past leads us to is to try to transcend that, to open our hearts to people. But it also seems that unless we have an honest relationship to our anger and to our hate at this level, that we're kidding ourselves when we try to transcend it and it just kind of ferments down there.
Exactly.
And we have a false kind of path.
You've got to be careful not to get phony holy. But the way in which you work with anger is to acknowledge it, that you feel it. The expression of it to other people is something that can create more stuff. And after a while, you begin to realize that the important part of it is that you acknowledge that you have that anger. And then, as quickly as you can, you keep just letting it go. You don't push it away. You don't deny it. But as quickly as you can, you let it go. I had this very extraordinary experience with my guru in India. He would keep us in the back of the temple, and every now and then he'd call one of us forth and sort of play with us a little bit. And I'd get called, Ram Dass, Maharaj, he wants to see you. And I go rushing up to get the highest truth. And he'd say, Ram Dass, give up anger. No, he'd say, love everyone. I'd say, yes, Maharaji, and I'd rush back. And then he'd call me later, and I'd go rushing up. He'd say, Ram Dass, tell the truth. Yes, Maharaji, and I'd rush back. The next day, he'd call me up. Yes, Maharaji. Ram Dass, love everyone. Yes, jao, go. I'd call up, Ram Dass, tell the truth. And he did this day after day after day. Finally, I realized the truth was I didn't love everyone. Was I going to tell the truth, or was I going to love everyone? And I decided in the past, I always made believe I loved everyone, which wasn't truthful. So this time I tell the truth. The truth was I detested all the people that were around me. And there were 30 of them, the Western satsang. I couldn't stand them. They all seemed like, you know, manipulative exploiters. So I started to put signs on my door, keep out, and I got furious. But within a week or two, I was so angry at everybody that at the time I was not carrying money. Which meant I had a bag man that carried the money. It was a little phony, but... And he'd put the money in the bus for me so I could go to the temple. And I was so mad at even him that I wouldn't let him put the money in, so I had to walk to the temple. I was so angry. And I walked the 8 miles, and everybody else went on the bus. And I got there, and I was furious, getting angrier and angrier. And I looked down, everybody was eating and so happy and playing with Maharaji, and I got furious. And I came down, and somebody brought me food. And I took up the food and I threw it at him. And my guru was sitting across the courtyard and he says, Ram Dass? And I went over there and he says, something troubling you? And this is in Hindi. I said, yes, I hate all those people and I hate myself. The only person I like is you. I love you. He says, you love me? I said, yes. He was patting me on the head and he got some milk and he was pouring it down my throat. And he was crying too. And then he came up to me and he said, I told you to love everyone. I said, yeah, but you told me to tell the truth. And the truth is I don't love everyone. And he came up nose to nose and he said, love everyone and tell the truth. What he was saying is, when you finish being who you think you are, this is who you're going to be. And he said, you give up a little anger each day and I'll help you. And I started to do that. About 2 weeks later, then I walked across, I looked across these people, all of whom I hated, and I saw that one level under it, I really loved them, but I couldn't stand them, you know, that level. And I went over and I cut up a piece of apple, and I went to feed each person, and I knew that if you feed somebody with anger, you're giving them poison. So I'd hold the thing and look at them, and I was so right about every reason I was angry. I mean, righteousness is the root of, you know, it's, I was righteously angry, you know. And I saw, he said, let it go. And I just, by sheer will, just kept letting it go and saw their beauty and stuck the apple in their mouth. It took me about an hour and a half to do everybody. 2 weeks later, I was angry at him. And he opened his mouth and said, you gonna give me a piece of apple? That was great. But what's happened over the years is, as I've given up a little, acknowledging it, letting it go. Acknowledging it, letting it, not making believe I don't have it. Not making me. And when I have relationships with people where we have a contract for truth, I will say, you know, I'm really pissed off at you. But we hear, what we have also is the other level where we love each other enough to be straight that way. And we cultivate both levels of it. The only contract of truth is that you acknowledge it. Remember, the game isn't to change someone else. They are just being who they are. This is an interesting flip that happens when you start on the spiritual journey. You realize your game isn't to change another person. They're just being just who they are. Your job is to deal with the reactions you're having to who they are. See, we constantly get into, if only you'd be this way, I could be happy. There's another flip of it. You're being who you are. Now I'll do with it. If you get to me, great, this is my problem. It's a different kind of work on oneself in a relationship. Questions? Talk about fear tactics and religion. In the uncertainties of this, there's a Chinese curse that says, may you be born in an interesting time. And you could consider it a curse or a blessing, depending on what level of work you're doing. And when there is uncertainty, like economic uncertainty, terrorism, the bomb, ecological disasters at every turn, I mean, it's stuff that if you're alert, you're aware that you're right on the edge of all the time. A lot of people respond to that uncertainty and anxiety, uncertainty with fear. And the way they dissipate their fear, various strategies. One strategy is to just buy more stuff, to get more pleasure now because it's all going to be gone soon. That's one thing. That's the materialist strategy. Then there is the strategy that really we're working with, which says the fear is rooted in our sense of separateness. Let's work for our deeper unity. There is another alternative, which is to feel that you will reduce the fear if you align yourself with good as opposed to evil. In other words, it's in the world of good and evil. And if you are part of the elect or part of the good guys and you push away the bad guys, somehow you will be protected from the uncertainties of the world. And so people grab on to a belief system which makes them feel that they are in the right. And it reduces some of their anxiety. In order to hold on to that, they have got to convince themselves that other people are not in the right. They've got to polarize the world. And they create a lot of ours is the only way, and if you don't do it, you're missing it and you're wrong. What you have to have is just a lot of compassion for the stages other people are in. When I meet a fundamentalist who feels that I'm the work of the devil, I feel that I can understand how their faith is flickery enough so they have to have that belief. And I will oppose their actions if they try to limit my freedom or somebody else's freedom. But I will understand why they're caught in that. And I'll keep my heart open as well as I can. It'll close sometimes and then I'll have to open it again. It closes all the time. It's like a yo-yo a lot. Then I have to open it again. When you meet a mensch in any religion, when you meet somebody that is a cooked goose, somebody that has really done the work, there's none of these issues of my way and your way and you're going to go to hell because you use your way. None of that even exists. When I meet a Zen Roshi or a Bhikkhu in Theravadan or a Lama or a Father Damasius, a beautiful Benedictine monk. He and I were dancing around his desk once, and he wasn't saying, you're not a good Christian, and last week I was at the 92nd Street Y in New York with Reb Zalman Schachter, and we were talking about Judaism, and he wasn't sitting around saying, you're not a good enough Jew. When you look, you meet another being, and you recognize the spirit, and you trust the spirit. Beliefs, religious beliefs, always come out of a slightly lesser space. They come out of still feeling separate a lot. Yes. The wisdom that is inherent in higher levels of consciousness, or as Gurdjieff talks about the higher faculties or whichever system you want to use, has to do with transcending the way in which the intellect knows. And the way to get into that intuitive being in the, it's like Einstein, for example, said, I didn't arrive at my understanding of the fundamental laws through my rational mind. What he did was, and he describes in other places, he got so one-pointed in his problem-solving that his mind went through like a laser into another realm where he was in a gestalt subjective universe where he was the answer. And then he came back down into Albertness, who happened to be a good physicist, And he brought down a thread of that stuff back in, which was E equals MC squared, which changed all of our lives. Bach goes in, comes back, Brandenburg Concerto. Mozart didn't even go in and out. He just had the door open. He was just copying it as fast as he could. Michelangelo sees a lower plane and does the Sistine Chapel. I mean, it's everybody sees different things. The person that you think you are never gets into those realms. You die along the way. That's the problem. So what you're doing is just designing your own death, psychological death. And what you're doing is thinning all the techniques for quieting the mind, which extricates yourself from your own thinking mind. Like, for example, I went to Rangoon, Burma a year before last, and I sat for months in a meditation cell in a monastery, 800 Burmese and 5 Westerners. And from 3 in the morning till 11 at night, all I did was follow the muscle that rose and fell in my abdomen. And every time it rises with each breath, you notice rising. Every time it falls, you notice falling. And the instruction is to deepen your concentration, bring your awareness back to the rising and falling in the abdomen. Now, if you watch what happens, you sit there and you go rising, falling, rising, falling. And then each thought comes along and says, psst, think me, I'm real, see? Like you're going rising, falling, and then the thought comes, this'll never work, see? And if you buy into that thought, you say, right, it'll never work. Well, see you later, see? But the teacher says, bring your awareness back to your thought, to your rising, falling. Rising, falling, right? Then another one, my knee hurts, or when is lunch, or, I mean, they go on and on. The one that really gets you is rising, falling, rising. I think something's happening. That one really gets you. That's the one that sucks you. And in each case, you've got to come back and come back and come back and come back until your mind gets so quiet. Then you see that even the concept of somebody sitting in Rangoon meditating was just a thought. And finally, there is just the rising and falling. And you've disappeared into the right. That's the beginning exercise. Then your mind becomes like a laser and you start to pierce into the universe and the truths of the universe. For example, then you begin to see, when I hold up my hand, you see hand. But what you're seeing is a light and shadow, and then your conceptual mind going through a huge computer race is spitting out the concept hand and it's applying it to this phenomena that you're seeing, these phenomena. And what happens as your mind gets quiet is you see what's called the nama and the rupa separate. You see the mind go out and grab the phenomena and make it something. You begin to see your mind doing it all the time. It's like Christ saying, look, I'm making all things new. And at that point, you're beginning to see the way in which the universe is created. See the nature of the impermanence of it, all the deeper things that the Buddha pointed out. And the Buddha was beautiful. He said, don't take my word for it. You do it and you experience it for yourself. So these are the techniques. I think we have to stop now. Yes. Okay, I just got my message. We turn back into a pumpkin. One thing I want to just say is, it seems to me incredible grace that you and I have enough food in our belly and enough and a roof over our head and a political system that allows us to come together to do this. That in the history of civilization, it is rare indeed that people have the opportunity to explore Dharma this way. And this doesn't mean we should be guilty about it. This is our part in the total dance. And we work on ourselves and we offer the fruits of our working back in. And if we develop equanimity and peace, we bring equanimity and peace back into the world. So that we're playing our parts by doing this, but it's still extraordinarily graceful moment these evenings. In India, when we meet in part, we say namaste, which means I honor the place in you where when you're in yours and I'm in mine, there's only one of us. Namaste.
This concludes Cultivating the Heart of Compassion with Ram Dass. Music by Glenn Velez from Rhythms of the Chakras, available through Sounds True. For additional copies of this recording, or for a complete catalog of transformational audio and video tapes and music from the heart of the world, please call Sounds True, 800-333-9185, or write the Sounds True catalog, P.O. Box 8010, Boulder, Colorado, 80306. You may also visit us on the World Wide Web, www.soundstrue.com. Thank you for listening.